Sorry about that. I spoke with you about that yesterday and I had that. I was saying that we're hoping to be done by 12, if it is at all possible. Going forward, we will then take what we discussed, put that into a document, and present it to Parliament. Yesterday we had gone a very long way in terms of the annual report itself. The committee then agreed that we would go away and apply our minds to one or two other matters that we might not have thought about yesterday, and allow the AG to then respond to those questions. The AG had captured the ones that we had put on the table. I want to propose a slight change in that if there are any further questions that members would want to put, let them put those questions. Note also the questions that you're putting. AG, when you do your strat plan, you try to everything together, because some of those things are covered in the strat plan. And those are not covered in the initial, we can always remind them about it. Rather than having an hour doing this and then coming back, because I think they're all somehow interlinked. So we will ask members if there are any other questions to talk about overnight. AG will then capture them. And in your presentation of your strat plan, hopefully some of the questions will be covered, and if they are any outstanding, you'll decide then at that time how we manage them. Is that okay with members? All right. If that agrees with members, let us then move on and allow members just a second round of questions if indeed they have. We'll try and capture them and then invite the AG as we go along, which ones have not been covered in your presentation. And take it from there. So I am opening up for members if they have any further questions that you might have thought about that we didn't cover yesterday. I'm hoping actually that you've covered those that we raised yesterday. I know that I started capturing them halfway through, but I'm sure members will remember the questions that they've asked themselves. So you'll be number one, sir. You'll be number two, sir. These additional questions that you want to pose, and hopefully the AG will cover them. In his direct plan, let's take those first two questions.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, everybody. Please forgive me if my question sounds a little obvious, but I don't come from accounting or a financial background. When I sort of reviewed the documents about yesterday, it struck me, I don't understand why it is that you sit with a surplus and yet there's so many debts outstanding and uncollected. I thought surely the one should set off against the other in accounting terms, the way I understand it. I would start for an explanation as to how that happens. How is it that there's so much money owed to you and yet you sit with such a huge surplus? Can you just give me a picture as to how that works? And then secondly, I just wanted to know, do you conduct any form of forensic auditing? In other words, to establish whether criminal activity is underway. If you come across something that looks strange or an anomaly in the books that you're auditing, do you then go in depth into that to sort of seek out and discover criminal activity? Thank you, Chair.
The last one, so we try and capture everything. If we talk about a surplus and so on, AG, I'm not sure if it's still the current practice, but certainly in my whole life, there was always this complaint that your audit fees were deemed to be very high. Now, we saw it that you had a 32% markup, so when you deal with your surplus and all that, how does that relate to what you charge for audit fees? Is that the reason why people are not paying? So if you could just answer all those type of things. I just wanted to add to your questions there. Because it all deals with the surplus and all. Because at some point today, members, we need to deliberate because we are duty bound to make a pronouncement on what happens to the surplus. So that at least they know that. Because it's two options. The one option is that we allow them to continue to use it as retained income. Their own purpose, or we struck them to preterhitimus. That decision we must take some time today. That's, I think, it's an important question. Do you have any other questions? Okay. Yes.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair. Maybe a little bit also on the question of interest. There are municipalities, Chair, that are financially distressed and unable to pay their dues. Obviously, there would be interest charged on what they owe. And my question is, as long as they are unable to pay, does the AG keep on adding interest? Does adding to their woes when they are unable to pay anyway? Just want to check that on the question. But furthermore, Chair, I'm of the opinion that the internal audit unit is also very important for the kind of outcome that the AG is going to come up with. I'm following this question from what the chairperson asked yesterday about the external auditors, whether would it make sense for us to invite them for interrogation, so to speak. But I think the internal audit unit also, since it plays an integral part, we need also to find a way the head of the internal unit is the one who's expected to give a report or to flag red signals to either the audit committee or management. But at times, the internal audit looks at the errors, investigates and identifies problems within a particular department. And that might create a tension between management and itself, considering the levels at which they are. A head of internal audit is not a Section 87. So he's expected to raise issues to a person about him. So that might create some problems. And not to make recommendations. And recommendations which might not go well with management. Now, to prevent independence of the internal unit, can't we look, Chair, at the possibility of reviewing the reporting line so that it's able to report directly to the mayor and directly to the council? Because there could be the possibility of some reluctance on the part of the person about it in terms of the implementation of its recommendations. So I would like the AG to comment on that. Chair, if you allow me. Okay. I also need clarity on the selection of these undergraduate students for training and 34 for scholarship. In the report, it is mentioned that the assistance is once off. So I don't want to share. You say once off. I say within the term of the AG's office. What does that mean? If that be the case, it's within once off within the term, how then do you continue? Because I think there should be a continuation of the identification and assistance of these undergraduates and the scholarships for the continuation and the beating up of stuff in the AG's office. Chair. Lana said that my focus is on the municipalities. A student has told us that I accept that in a period of 3 years, you find that three different companies have been appointed to do work, 3 consecutive years. So in that instance, there is no continuation because you would state your case to a particular company for this year, say, but the explanation that I'm going to give for this particular issue is this, okay, fine. It's addressed or it's not addressed in the management letter that comes thereafter. The following year, a new company comes. It's going to ask the same question and have different understanding or comment of the same problem. So I'm saying this is a matter that I think needs to be looked at so that you have a if a problem has been raised, does not come up in 3 consecutive years, whereas it has been addressed. So I think it's a matter that has to be looked at. Yeah. Let me pause there for now. Thank you very much.
My question, I just need clarity. I think from the presentation yesterday, it was not clarified enough. Because I think one of the things that you should be doing to make sure that the mistakes like a certain increases don't happen as we always have all these books from different states of government. But what I wanted to find out is that do you have measures in place to make sure that when you do, when the, to help, or when you are dealing with auditing, measures in place to make sure when, as they do procurement, it's in line with MFMA and PFMA?
One more AG. On page 103 of your report, you show that you dispensed about 665 million rand to contractors. Now, I'm assuming that is to outsource firms to do work for you. The question that I'm asking is for you to give us indications. If I see that as an opportunity of BEE and that type of thing. So if you could just give us an indication of that contract work, one, do you have a policy that X goes to BEE and X goes to big companies, or how do you determine, because I think it's an opportunity for the small companies that need to get some sort of exposure. We have this problem in the legal fraternity, where lawyers are saying black lawyers are never being given opportunities. I think the same thing would apply with auditors. If we've got 600 million, are we consciously trying to use some of that as a platform for small and emerging black audit firms? Any more? Then we head over to Daisy. Is that it? We're not going to get another bite unless there's something that is pressing. So I think let's just throw the questions. I'm sure they should be noting them, and we will keep track of them. I want to take it as a last round of questions. Number one, anybody else? Okay, it will be the last, and then we hand over to the AG to present his spread plan and try and deal with some of these questions. So,
Chair, with regards to the rural school problems, which are quite good problems, very commendable, the corporate social investment of the office. The report says, how do the seven schools have been adopted. So I started to check, and they're all right. Having adopted them, focus is given to grade 10 to 12 for information sharing. So I just wanted to check, why can't we do it from grade 8 instead of grade 10? Because from primary school, they started at grade 8, the secondary school. I wish we could have started earlier. Chair, I did mention before the tension which arises between in a situation where the internal audit is involved. Here, I don't know whether it's just a comment, but the issue will just respond the way it's got a take on it. Well, the opinion, Chair, that like I said, where the audit, the internal audit makes recommendations, and there is some form of reluctance to implement those recommendations. Like I've indicated, it might be because of the levels that differ. But I also feel that if we could find a way, maybe in the performance arguments of the HODs or the MNs, they should be included. The recommendations of the audit, the internal audit, should be included in that performance argument. In the implementation of the recommendations of the internal audit, they should be included, so that we find a way of forcing them to implement those recommendations. Yeah, I think that would be all. Thank you.
Any thanks? Let's hand over to you, AG, and your team. You have the gist of some of the issues raised by members. Just to remind you that the final product of our report, so this is an opportunity for you to input the content of our report. And by responding to some of these questions, it then removes the internal debates that you will have, because we have received clarity on some of the matters that members undoubtedly will raise and want to include in the report if they are not satisfied. So really, AG, it's up to you. We will allow you time. We'll try and check the questions that have been raised in terms of their answers. And hopefully all will have recovered, and we will then be in a position to go and write our own report, present it to Parliament. As I said, members, there's the issue around the surplus that we must deal with. If it's the last thing we deal with before they leave, I think let's deal with that they get a sense of what's our view. And it's a simple question. Do we afford them the opportunity to use the 99 million rand or however it is, or do we instruct them to return it to national treasury? That's the one. And then, AG, in your answer, I thought I understood you to be saying that you resolved that issue of the Minister of Finance. If indeed you did it, that's fine. Just let us know that we can formally respond to the Minister saying, look, this is now water under the bridge and it's been resolved. Again, in your responses, if you could assist us with that one. Because that was a matter that was raised directly with us. We will then respond and say that it's no longer the case. And then, maybe you talk, and I think it will go to the question that you've raised or that was raised earlier on about the surplus and so on, and stroke the outstanding debt. But in our own discussion with this, we will then have to discuss and see how we resolve it, because it is a problem one way or the other. Whether it is self-made or it's paid by the local municipalities, it is a problem. But in our own ones, we will deliberate. So, AG, if you want to put your 2 cents worth, because you probably won't be there when we deliberate on it, you can do that also. So it's really a free for all on your side. It's an opportunity for you to influence Parliament in terms of its report. To hand it over to you, it is 9:30, maybe 10:30, 10:45 or so. I'm not going to put you under pressure, but the members are going to leave by 12 o'clock so they can catch their flight. I get a nod from all members, that's fine. So let's hand over to you, AJ. could interrupt the Auditor General and truly indicate that he and his team are done with whatever they wanted to do this morning.
Thank you very much, sir. Good morning. Thanks for the questions once more and the additional questions. I'm sure that my colleagues, when we go through this presentation, will also assist and add areas that I would not have covered everything. At the outset, as we go through this presentation, we also want to cement the purpose for what we do. Largely in the institution, we focus on work that will enable oversight, accountability, and governance in the public sector. So the questions that were raised, I guess, will also revolve around a number of those issues. I thought perhaps I'll incorporate just the kickoff to our presentation of the problem, our business model as an office. as it is a mandatory task of the audit office to audit government departments, public entities, municipalities, and entities, as well as to make sure that the other audits of a discretionary nature that are performed. So this is what we are seized with as an office on an annual basis. We report and table every report that we finalize to each of the legislatures, and we also publish two general reports. One is the general report on the audit outcomes of national and provincial departments, which is the work that we are currently busy with as we speak. We've already tabled the last immediate past financial year for municipalities in the form of the general report on the MFNA, which we tabled in Parliament and in the respective provinces at the end of July this year. So effectively, what we then, in terms of our structure as an office, as members will remember, we exist in all of these nine provinces with a head office in Pretoria. A head office that also focuses on the audit of national portfolios in particular, as well as a lot of the administrative and support functions for the whole office. So we have a staff strength on average in each of those provinces, way in excess of 100. I'm sure the smallest is 120 of us, but we have a presence. And so that's how we are put together, and I'm sure it will be clear in the paper slides. The way that we are structured in order to put ourselves in the best position as an office to report and to meet our annual responsibilities, we have structured the office such as the Deputy Auditor General as the accounting officer in terms of the Public Audit Act, oversees and heads the administration of the office. And that administration of the office includes everything from delivering on all those audits that are indicated across the whole country. We've spread up the office, Chair, so I'm just going to spend a little bit of time here because it will answer a lot of the questions as well in respect of our costings and all of us. We have a Deputy Auditor General, as I indicated, who is the accounting officer, to whom there are two distinct functions that we also put out in the office. The one function which I'm going to spend a lot more time on is the role of the National Leader Audit Services. That is a role that oversees the delivery of all these audits that we do every year, where we have below the national leader, we've got corporate executives who are responsible for different portfolios of work that we do.
Can we turn the line?
other one, page 24 of the annual report. In the main annual report, it's also. So in order, as I said, to head out to all the audit sites, which cover all municipalities, which cover all the provinces, municipal departments and entities, we have structured ourselves into clusters of portfolios, where we've got the corporate executive who's responsible for a number of national departments that we audit. We distinguish these, if one looks at this diagram, as National A, National B, National E, National C, and so on, which is a split of the different departments as we know them, including entities that operate under those departments. So each one of those corporate executives will then be given a number of departments to look after for purposes of the audit, as well as two provinces on average. So each one of the key executives who are responsible for driving communication and delivery of these audits will have those type of portfolios. If one looks at the national portfolios, that's where all of the staff in the national department are located. There will be a group of people, for example, who are responsible. Let's take an example, National A. National A will have such audits as public works, such audits as the presidency, charities, and so on and so on. And there will be teams of people at head office who are responsible on a day-to-day basis to look after the audit requirements, as well as any matters pertaining to the work we deliver on these audits. And so it happens with other national departments where different departments are clustered in ways that we have determined internally. And then we go down to the provinces where each of the operating executives has got a province attached to them or two. In this instance, if I look at the red as an example, that particular corporate executive, who is Alice Muller, looks after National D as well as Limpopo and Free State. And in turn, Limpopo and Free State have also got their own provincial head, which is the business executive, who looks after the activities of the office as we have reflected in the map up there. When all of these portfolios come together, honorable members, they help us firstly produce initially the financial statements that we audit every year based on the monies that are allocated to departments, to functions, or to any entities that are publicly funded. We then consolidate that work after we release the report to these people, and we also, once we release the report, enter into over 1,000 people effectively who are part of this team. In addition, addition to that, we've also got some support questions that help us with visibility programs, that help us with researching certain areas of audit that require constant improvement, areas that require clarity to be given in matters pertaining to where there may have been a dispute of one kind or another in the interpretation of the application of accounting auditing standards. So we've got a strong team of technical expertise, as it were, whose job is to extend the level of research and development work that are required to keep the team up to date on all technical matters that they need to comply with as they implement the audit. So it is a machinery, therefore, that is self-lubricating in most instances, because we pick up, based on our reports on these audits, certain issues that require to be clarified. And among them is the matter that the chair referred to in respect of the letter received from the Minister of Finance. It was one of those items, among many others, where we always have a regular interaction between ourselves as auditors and those that we audit, as well as those that look after the accounting framework against which we audit. So we do expect from time to time that there will be issues where we do not see the same thing, because ultimately what matters in terms of the conclusions that we reach is the combination of the evidence that we have been able to identify together with the application of our technical knowledge in arriving at a judgment call as to what the conclusion of financial statements is. So the issues of dispute in this context were part of the game, part of the natural evolution of an audit, because as systems mature and as disciplines respond to new challenges, there will always be higher issues that need to be considered. And I think this issue about the modified cash standard, as an example, is a matter that is often dealt with within our technical environment. And therefore, that's why I indicated earlier that as much as we have not finalized the response to it, but we probably just missed the mechanism to handle it because we've got that particular part in our structure. So the audit function, therefore, Chair, what it also does in terms of coming to how we're going to do this work, as it is appreciated now coming to the finance part of things within the same audit delivery finance division, we have been allowed in legislation to run an open account. An open account in the sense that those people that we audit, we meet with them frequently and decide and engage with them that these are the number of hours that we believe it is going to take us to do the audit. And we enter into an engagement with them to indicate that we expect to spend, for example, 2,000 hours to be able to put this audit to completion. And that determination of the hours is often triggered by, firstly, our understanding of the activities and the business of the entity that we audit, which then translates into a risk assessment that we do as to what is it that will be expected of us at a minimum as auditors to be able to come to a conclusion on the financial statements. We convert that into hours because we can determine that if a particular department has got a large number of complex fixed assets that are sitting in distributed sites, it might take an effort to get out to those sites and inspect those assets as well as through certain verification processes. And then we know that upfront we can predict the number of hours that we will take to do the audit. We then also looked at how do we determine the rate per hour, because we can give them hours against which we are going to be doing that project back. Because we know the number of people is finite in terms of based on our understanding and the risk assessment. We then put in place a process to determine a rate per hour. And the rate per hour is largely determined by the work we need to do together with the facilities that we will need to support the work that we do. So we do have a robust costing exercise to come to a rate, which rate together with the hours comes to what we expect each one of these business units to contribute towards recovering the costs of performing the audit. Once we put that across to the auditees, we then have an idea as to how much we are going to raise as a fee based on the agreed hours as well as the rate that we have agreed to them. So that how we generate the income that we have in our books, Chair. Each income, when we have received it, or rather when we have raised it because normally we raise the invoice before we get the money. I'm trying while I'm going through this to deal with some of the questions that we raised as well. When we raise the invoice, and an invoice is obviously a request to pay. Until such time that it has been paid, it's still a request to pay. So that request to pay, which is an invoice, for example, of R1 million, and the cost associated with generating that R1 million are 800. We still have a surplus between the R1 million and the 800. But what we don't have is the R1 million in the bank. That's why we can have a surplus coexisting with the debt. Because to come to a surplus is the difference between the R1 million revenue invoice minus the 800,000 cost, which gives you the surplus of 200,000. But by the same token, you probably would only have received, let's say, 500,000 of that million in the bank. You still have a debt of 500,000, which has not been paid. Hence, there can be a coexistence between a debt and a surplus. And that's what we have in our situation. So the key generator, as I was saying, of income for the office is largely the work that we do, because we raise invoices based on the model and we collect the cash. So you don't get it, it remains in our books as debt. If I flip over to the other side and look at the nationally the internal operations and audit support functions, these are largely functions that are also related and linked to the work that we do in the audit side. As I said earlier on, our technical support, our learning activity, which is our learning and development function in the office, as well as the likes of quality control and so on, fall within the broader overall transversal support activities for the office. Alongside another client-facing group of people who are sitting on the internal operations and audit support is the performance audit function, the investigations and the information systems function. Let me just deal with investigations, seeing that's linked to one of the questions raised earlier. The investigations capacity that we have currently in the office is largely reactive in terms of how it is positioned, because we understand our mandate largely to be that of auditing and reporting. And there was a time in the office when we have an investigations unit where it was highly utilized at different periods in the cycle. It is not often that people, when they are thinking of investigating something, that they will think of the Auditor General as the first reference place to go to, as an example, because we do not do investigations every day, hence the capabilities that we have are limited. And therefore, we said that in the light of other investigative capabilities having emerged over the last couple of 5 to 10 years, for example, who have got investigations as their daily bread, it might be difficult for us to position ourselves in respect of certainly attracting the skills, but the point is, once they are here, how are you going to utilize them if they are only dependent on somebody coming to you to request an investigation? Because it may or may not come, but you will sit with people that you've employed where you were hoping to use them for investigations. But we said, let's not disappear from the scene, because there will be times where we need to respond, which is the case currently among us. So we've got a very small investigations capability, which does not normally track issues to determine criminality in essence. It doesn't do that because, as I say, the bulk of the skills that we have in our investigations unit are largely people who are able to investigate deviations from prescribed rules in supply chain management in a number of instances. They have training of an accounting and that kind of stuff, and their level of capability in following through on investigations, including those that are legal background, is limited to tracking transactions, not to track issues in terms of culpability or what was the reason behind somebody's behavior and those kind of things. So we've got that forensic capability. Another place that we use for is to work with our audit teams. Now we say to them, you are the people who are trained forensically, who've got an ability to identify forensic risks, even in the audit work that we do. The best thing we can utilize you for, therefore, is to be proactive in using you as part of a requirement of one of the international standards on auditing that we must comply with, which is ISA 240. It's an auditing standard on the determination of fraud and issues of fraud risk in financial statements and reporting. So we normally put those forensic auditors together with our audit teams so that when our audit teams plan their audits, they also take into account fraud-related risks when they design their audit procedures that they're going to use in testing our work that we do across all the departments in the regularity audit. So there are the capabilities that we use internally to make sure that the auditors that go out to audit have got even sharper capabilities and skills to respond to the risk of fraud and error in financial statements. So that's the two angles from which we look at them. For example, if there's an investigation in a particular municipality where we are required to investigate deviations from a policy that on supply chain, we will be able to do that. But there are certain investigations that we would not immediately affect, because sometimes investigations, when they come, they require certain specific industry expertise that people must have in order to respond to certain allegations. And we often find that it will be risky for us to take a particular engagement of an investigation's nature if we are not able to demonstrate that we do have the people with the necessary technical capability to execute an audit request. And therefore, Chair, this one is really one of those that we have not been pursuing from a growth point of view. It's used internally as an internal support to advance our audit skills. Now, in addition, therefore, to these ones that I've highlighted, there's also responsibilities that provide us transversal support internally, the information technology and communications environment. We've heard yesterday when we reported in our annual report that this is one area where we've had some glitches in the area of internal control weaknesses, which we have started following up on. And a number of others, which are the communications and business management and process support functions, which help us in aligning our systems and being able to work with the organization as it is spread across the country with all manner of tools and facilities and technology availability and any other things that are required by our staff to do their work. For example, all our staff, when they go out and do their work, we issue them with laptops, which obviously require to be connected to our main server so that information can be stored, so that information can be protected and information can be kept for purposes of future retrieval should there be a need for it. We've also got in the same function the likes of our human capital, which is responsible for many human capital issues, which I'm going to deal with in further slides with regards to the type of activities, among other parties, that we drive when it comes to the retention of our people. For example, it is our human resource function with regards to the retention of staff. With regards to the retention of staff, that is I have to answer that question when I'm talking about the human capital slot. Part of the staff, I think there was a question raised regarding what sort of strategies do we have for staff retention. One of them is, for example, we continuously review our pay and benefits to align them to the market. This is part of the process where we would go out and find what the likes of PD corporate, what the likes of other remuneration survey institutions out in the private sector in South Africa society, how do they teach our profession in relation to other competitors for the same skills that we have. Because our skills are normally sought after not only in the accounting and auditing profession, but in a wide range of industries, financial services and all of that. So we often go through a process and go to the market to benchmark against other people who target our own talent. So we do that as a method of trying to make sure that we don't fall far behind and have a challenge with retaining our people. We've also extended study leave opportunities because we recruit people largely from universities who have not yet completed their postgraduate studies. And we also have introduced recently an in-house group retirement fund, which does not change the costing with regard to the office cost, because any employee who gets employed in the office, if, for example, they are on a 100,000 annual package, or you may say, We do have a retirement fund for certain people that joined the office after a particular date. So those ones, if we give them that, we just say you have an in-house retirement fund. You can choose for yourself where and how you want to put your retirement. All we will put in the office is to pay for the administration fee in respect of that. And this is a way of encouraging staff to save, because if they're left of their own and they see 100,000, they think that is for today's consumption. And really what we provide there is a way of getting them to, because particularly many of them, their first job has just come out of university and are trying to gain some traction in a professional environment. So these are the type of benefits that we try and provide them for an employee wellness program that provides all manner of support for various things, because, I mean, we employ people, as we say, across all 9 provinces, and I think they're exposed, like anybody else, to anything that happens in respect of life as we know it. Talent management system, where we provide them opportunities for internal mobility within the office, so that anyone who has got a serious consideration for being part of the office for the long term, there's a method through which we engage them to assess their interests as well as their career aspirations. Number of programs that we do for staff, just to make sure that we keep them alert to new developments within the sector that we operate in, as well as the challenges of the job that we do. So yeah, that's actually the stuff that we do in terms of the foundation elements of the office. How are we set up from a foundation's point of view? I'm sure some of the questions my colleagues who have seen the kind of stuff that came yesterday and today will also have, but I'll try and deal with some of the questions that I go through some of this in the presentation of our strategy. Now, if I step down from that part of the slide, which was really just to give an intro to what is the fair foundation of the Office in general. Now I'm going to talk about what we have put in our strategy as we ponder the future, because we were reporting to the members yesterday on how we have assessed our performance up to the year March 2014, and we have cast our eye into the horizon, as it were, in terms of this one. And we know that when we do that, we can hit it or we can miss it. But it is in the midst of all these things that we thought this is where we want to try things going forward as an office. So the kind of issues that I'm gonna share with the committee quickly on this one will just be to go through a quick environmental assessment that we have done in coming up with the issues that we want to focus on in the future. What are these issues that we want to focus in the future? And how do we see them being done, both in terms of the possible strategic initiatives that we are going to try to add on to the work that we have been doing up to currently. So, one of the things that we faced as we were reflecting on the way forward in terms of this strategy was also to look at what is happening in the external environment. Obviously, there's changes that have taken place already. There's more interest in the citizenry, among others, on the work that we do, because every time we come up with this work in the public domain, it always has an attractive interest on the part of those that live around us. We looked at some of the gains and the global competitiveness index, which looks at issues of public administration, where we found to be lagging behind. We're currently in an environment where financial resources are very tight and a very tight competition for skilled labor, including the people we employed, as well as the key focus in government on driving delivery, among others, in areas like education, health, infrastructure, as well as social functions. In the external environment, our auditees are continuously improving also on their own information systems environment, and big data also brings its own challenges when it comes to the responsiveness of an auditor, because an auditor was used to auditing environment with a lot of paper floating around, and suddenly there's a change in the operating environment which indicates that more and more information systems are being used as platforms to store and manage information in departments. It requires us to respond, because we might find ourselves looking at work based on eyes that are driven by past technology. An enormous increase in the use of social media is also another factor that we think will always obviously have an impact on us, because people, if they no longer read things on paper and they see the benefit of using information in the public domain from other sources, we need to be alive to what that means for us. And if you look at the journey thus far, Chair, we've said to ourselves, as we plan to develop our targets and future plans of an audit office, what is an outlook of where we have been in respect of audit outcomes? So we just thought, let's take stock of where we have been with regard to the audits that we're doing. We're coming from a period of 2006-07, according to what we have on this slide, where we have just a trickle of clean audits as we had defined them in our engagement yesterday. And we are moving to an era where currently we are sitting with a larger size of audit outcomes that are classified in the improvement phase. On the yellow bar, which is the unqualified, we also see that the bar in respect of percentage is growing, which means there's a lot of entities and departments that have migrated out of the purple space being the qualified audits. So it's an interesting graph in that it shows that over the years that we have been embarking on this visibility campaign, we've observed, among others, that what brought about some of those improved audit outcomes had been the footprint as well as the interactions that we have had with a number of the entities and departments. And we think that something has been gained over the work that we've done, which we are reflecting on in our annual report, because it is evident from looking at it over the last 6-7 years that something is significantly different is starting to take shape in the area of financial management and accountability. Even though we were sitting with quite a number of adverts and disclaimers, they are now starting to become the exception rather than the rule. And that is what they're seeing in the area of national departments in particular. If you look at municipalities, certainly there's a little bit more red here, I think, where we're coming from as well in the 6-7 period when one looks at municipalities. And I think I'm highlighting this so that we can also have some fresh reflection of what the journey we have been on has been about, where for a period of time the emergence of clean audits had been largely escaping the municipality sector. We started seeing some emergence of certain audits coming out as clean audits, and certainly a shrinking number of those that are adverse and disclaimer, even though we still have qualified and other disclaimers in double digits. But at least it does paint a picture of this journey not being static, but starting to show the potential to move in the direction that we as an office are influencing, as we shared in our mission statement. These reasons for improvements to the journey over the audit outcomes for both MFMA and PMA, we've attributed them largely to the attention that has been given to the 6 areas that we are influencing action around. One of these influences that we have been driving over time had been the improvement in the accounting disciplines for our financial statement reporting, the ability to manage supply chain management in a manner that is transparent and fair. And we still have a number of significant challenges in that area in terms of what improvements have come forth. Two of the issues that are key drivers of these audit outcomes we have highlighted is the prevalence of vacancies and increased instability in key positions, in key positions, where when certain commitments are made by an accounting officer in one quarter, and the next quarter somebody else who then starts afresh again. So it causes a significant slowdown in the process towards accelerating the achievement of that audit outcomes, issues of instability, issues of minimum competences, particularly in local government, where the minimum competences required for certain positions in supply chain, in financial management and all that, have not yet been put in place. The ownership that we've seen taken by the leadership is evident from our key control interactions on a quarterly basis. We're starting to see the OT management taking some firm steps and own up to the key controls that we are promoting. The responsiveness in respect of designing well-developed internal controls as well as monitoring audit action plans is another factor we believe is contributing to the improved governance. The audit quality is assurance from the departments and the entities that we audit have also shown some positive improvement. Hence, we believe that we still have a need and a role to play in driving this visibility program because it's linked to activating the actions that must be taken to improve financial management. And we have done the same with regard to the MECs, the mayors, and so on. So our footprint in the provinces does demonstrate that with more and more nurturing and persuasion with regards to these auditable terms, a lot more people start taking them seriously. We embarked on this journey of visibility chair way back when we developed what we refer to as the Sianova documents in 2001, which was a trigger for this strategy plan that we are now concluding on, where we said that if we are to be successful in what we do, it will be when our stakeholders say so. We've developed quite a lot of issues regarding quality and service excellence based on that strategy, and we got our teams to align themselves to this journey over the years that we have been running this visibility program. Between the period 2009 and 2012, we had, as I said yesterday, what we called a door-to-door campaign, where we went to all the municipalities to engage the municipalities as well as the mayors and the municipal managers on their roles and responsibilities when it comes to overseeing financial management and local government. A lot of responses that we are seeing partly in these financial statements and this report come from those interactions, because we never did that as a once-off and left it. When we did it, we decided let's put some seeds in it by putting in place a key control program where our local staff in a particular province are the ones who go back on a quarterly basis to check whether the commitments made are being driven by leadership towards improved financial controls. The period 2010-13 was also characterized by roadshows, which we hadn't do, that's where we introduced, and those roadshows are when we communicate our audit outcomes to the people that ought to act on them. And we often say here that when we come out on the roadshows, the only preoccupation in our minds is to talk to the people who have got the direct accountability for these audit outcomes, to highlight and to elevate the issues that they need to be responded to in their departments as they exercise oversight, so that when we complete our audit process and we issue our general report, we don't talk about them in that report if we have not yet talked to them. And it's a mechanism to make sure that there's no undue tension when we report on outcomes of the work that we do. In the meantime, we have not engaged those that are the primary stakeholders in terms of their responsibility to actually activate the witnesses identified. We've also considered these quarterly interactions as a very important part of the audit, because it is not doing management's work, but it is bringing to the attention of management the primary things that are going to make them successful when it comes to improving the core administrative environment. And one of the most recent developments that we've also been working on was then to help in developing a combined assurance model, which is an engagement that incorporates the senior management of an institution, brings to the attention of the fair level of assurance, which is largely the people inside the organization, as well as the audit committee and internal audit, as well as the third level of assurance, which is typically the portfolio committees, as well as SCOPA, among others. So we say that if we've got this combined assurance model, and everybody in this combined assurance model do what they are expected to do in overseeing the work of the departments, we might end up an improved set of outcomes in the future. And of course, the journey of the general report, as well as the PFMA and MFMA, where we have focused in each of those years over the journey on different issues, the commitments that were made, the audit outcomes, as well as the combined analysis, as I say. So this is just to map a picture in terms of what are the things we have been focusing on which have contributed to the type of positive outcomes we have seen. The stakeholders that we have identified primarily in each of these 6 years that we regularly find time to engage with, and we've done this almost without exception for all those 3 spheres, being the national executive, the DGs and the CFOs, and so it goes with provinces and locals as well. So that the conversation about what the next steps that need to be taken to deal with budget outcomes are not lost to all those that are part of the combined assurance model. And of course, we break it down to the key areas that matter. For us, it would obviously be the likes of the oversight and the speaker, as well as the portfolio committees and public accounts committees. And this is an area, Chair, where we, on a regular basis, bring to light what we are picking up. If it's supply chain, if it is financial statement, management issues, and so on, these are the interactions that we often open an engagement with, whether it's quarterly or annually in some instances. The tools of engagement in terms of these, Chair, we're busy working on them, and they are going to be part of what we capture in the strategic plan to make sure we improve them and make sure that the responsibility for the activities that arise from this visibility program is owned by the right people. We did via the roadshow slides where we paint the picture in terms of the audit outcomes as well as the drivers of these audit outcomes. We share briefing notes when we engage with the oversight committees in terms of the public accounts committees and our portfolio committees. And we also have a dashboard of key controls that we provide on a regular basis to make sure that everyone who we engage with knows why we believe a particular cycle of their control is green, yellow, or red, as well as the general reports ultimately which inform our stakeholders about the key conditions and the issues that we pick up as we go to the financial statement audits. One of the things in terms of this chair is a structured engagement that are taking place now to elaborate on the standards that have been developed, particularly the international standards that have been developed. As I said yesterday, we are championing development of the standard on the value and benefits of supreme audit institutions. And we have continuous work in this area, which is about making sure that our own report benefits from the international work that is being done elsewhere. Internally, if one looks at our strength internally in the organization, we believe that we have the required staff as well as the levels of competence that we need in order to perform this work. Currently sitting at 88% occupancy, and there's been a trend around the 80s over time. Our intake of training accountants, as well as making sure that we respond to the demands for information from the office, whatever ways that we are requested to. In terms of the profile of our workforce, there was a question raised yesterday as well regarding our workforce. This is the split in terms of our demographic profile. The professional qualifications that we have in the office comparing the period 2007 to where we are now, we've had a significant growth as can be seen on the numbers up there, where in 2007 there was somewhere around 291 CAs, and that has grown by some 150 over the period of time. And this is people that are retained in the office, and this number is obviously excluding those that are yet to finalize their exams. Others are going to be writing soon and so on. So it goes because of the people that are in the pipeline who are also searching for these exams. And the RGA, there's quite a number of people obviously with that RGA background. Many of them have reached retirement age. So we will always see some slow growth here because the RGA, which is the registered government auditor qualification, was provided for people who had to meet the minimum competency for them to continue, because many of them would have come into the office with only a matric, as an example, and some training that they may have been exposed to. But this RGA, which is the registered government auditor, was an effort to bring up to speed some of the people that wanted to have a minimum qualification for competency purposes. And therefore, the information systems auditor, it used to be a single-digit number not long ago, but at least now we've gathered some strength. It means our capabilities in the area of reporting and auditing information systems environments has also grown. And recently we've struck a relationship and an MOU with the ACTA, which is a qualification that has its origins on the British system, and you'll find a lot of people with this qualification across the continent. Going to the vision part of the presentation, Chair, we said to ourselves when we looked at where to from here, at the beginning of the year, we say that we are not about just issuing audit opinions. So we can't aspire to audit opinions, because audit opinions are a tool that we use to give an indication of where we are. But our aspiration as an office, when we look at it, we said, come 2024, if we're standing here now and we are casting our eye into the horizon, how should the public service be characterized when it comes to financial management matters? And we said that it would be good if we could characterize the public sector by institutions that have got robust financial and governance management systems as one. An environment that is characterized by strong oversight and accountability. Commitment and ethical behavior by all and competent value-adding auditor general. Those are the things that we said we would aspire to work hard at while we are doing our work, so that when we look back from there in 2024, we want to be able to say, are we seeing the emergence and establishment of robust financial and performance management systems, as an example, coming as a result of the things that we have been highlighting to our audits. So that when we do this audit work, it doesn't just end with what was our opinion, but it ends with what is now the characteristic of a public institution when it comes to financial management and performance reporting matters. Now, if we break down the area of robust financial and performance management systems, Chair, we then said for that to be the case, it must have this kind of characteristics: transparent and stable financial and performance management systems that are regularly maintained, led and managed by staff with strong technical skills and experience that is able to withstand changes and transitions. In positioning this aspiration, Chair, we are coming from the premise that our experience currently, in terms of the work that we are doing, as reflected in those slides of the journey of the audit outcomes, both municipalities and national and provincial, largely some of the root causes of negative audit outcomes is the fact that there are no appropriate skilled people in the financial management roles. If I may just also extend it and say, Chair, in terms of the guidance you gave us yesterday, part of what we have picked up in the National Development Plan, among others, is characteristics of this kind, where capable and well-trained people are the desirable mix of people in public service institutions that needs to be promoted. And we therefore said, as we look at it from our side, that must be something along the lines of well-trained people who lead financial management functions and responsibilities with the requisite skills as well as the necessary tools to do the job. Secondly, budgeting and planning processes that ensure the effective, efficient, and economical use of all public resources. The issue, Chair, around the unauthorized, irregular expenditures and all of that we spoke about yesterday. But it comes as a result, among others, of deficiencies in the budget and planning processes in certain cases, where even if expenditure had not been appropriated, but there are still lines of expenditure against it. And we think that if that is to be the kind of financial environment that we aspire to, at least the planning and budget processes must support the achievement of effective, efficient, and economical use of all public resources. Accounting officers, we've brought them into this as well and said, if accounting officers could be developed and promoted to the extent that they themselves take it upon themselves to proactively engage auditors and appraise the auditors about progress that they have made in delivering on their reporting as well as accountability matters. Currently, the way it happens now, we are the ones that engage on this quarterly engagement. We are not stopping to do it. All we're saying is that let the accounting officers also take part of the responsibility, because when we go through these engagements, it must not be us that are bringing the conversation, but we must be coming to the accounting officer to say, have you checked your management accounts for the last 6 months in your department or your municipality? We are coming to engage you in our key control discussion to assess and to appraise whether you've got a good status of accounting records, as an example, whether you've got a mechanism and controls to deal proactively with issues of supply chain management, whether you are aware that these are the financial numbers that are coming through your system at every quarter and all of that, so that we can, based on that interaction with the accounting officer, be able to walk away and say, come the time when the end of year audit arrives, we have an idea as to what are the major challenges that are likely to face that OT instead of that surfacing as a, as an emergency now at the end of the audit. Whereas with this particular intervention, it's about saying we're not doing your work for you. We're asking you to do that which the PFMA and MFMA provides. All we are coming to do is to have an engagement with you, to alert you to things if you might fall off the cracks in respect of focusing your attention in driving controls within the institution. Otherwise, this engagement, if we do it the way we have been doing it when we were doing the initial investment, it might not carry the level of accountability required of an accounting officer. So we are busy then dealing with the mechanics and the research work in the background so that we can elevate with the existing resources that we have in terms of people, because we've trained them in this area of key controls. All we are doing now, we are bringing an enhancement as part of our aspiration to say it must be the duty of an accounting officer, in the same way that they come to a portfolio committee, to have an engagement with us. And if we feel there are risks that have been identified that are so significant from a transparent reporting point of view, we will exercise our judgment to check whether there is no need to escalate risks before they become material prior to the financial year end. So this is where we're going to be gearing up over the next couple of years to actually make sure that audit outcomes no longer become a surprise, but there's a predictive red flag that we can use to our interactions. The next one is the area of supporting front internal audit capabilities, to say that if there are internal audits within the public sector that are strong, they are likely to contribute to a good internal control foundation. And that's one of the areas that we are committing ourselves to in the strategic plan, to make sure that it becomes a reality. There are already many efforts in the public sector, both on side of National Treasury and many other institutes that are hosting this particular area, including the Institute of Internal Auditors. We have recognized the value of promoting strong and credible internal audit capabilities in the public sector so that they can start responding to the issues of independence, the issues of reporting to somebody who does not have an overbearing influence because they corral the resources on others for internal audit internally, and therefore internal audit is unlikely to report decisively on certain issues to an accounting officer. So there's another trend we say, as part of our aspirations, if we look at where we could be in 10 years' time, this is another strength that needs to be promoted, at least by us, because we also evaluate our assessment of the effectiveness of internal audit as we do our work. We also want to provide accurate and empowering financial and performance reporting to ensure that oversight acts on what they need to act on. This is part of our commitment that if as an audit office we provide empowering financial and performance reporting, whether it is to portfolio committees or to public affairs committees or to any of those that are exercising oversight in the legislature, that's one of the key things that we ourselves want to contribute towards strengthening oversight and accountability. And also the promotion of the role of consequences is another key focus area over the next couple of years that I want to highlight, to say that for as long as there is no visible consequence on certain of the deficiencies that are taking place in the system in which we audit, the chances are that the improvements might be too slow or never come. And therefore, our sense is that in doing all of this, largely we will also be flagging the issue about consequences if there's a repeat of the same things that are taking place in any of the work that we do. And partly, this is about trying to restore integrity in the public, confidence in at least the systems that are driving public administration and financial management. And also, Chair, we also say here that our report and our interactions on a quarterly basis must also drive the appetite for low tolerance for lack of execution of controls and deviations from laws and regulations. Our report currently, when we look at it in terms of the deviation from controls and non-observance of laws and regulations, it's a very sticky point. It's an area where the likes of supply chain management deviations happen. And therefore, our reporting will also be taking a glance towards those ones, because those are some of the six key risk areas that we have been tracking over time. The promotion of this visible commitment will obviously be tested by the responsiveness of those that we engage with as to their appetite in, and their commitment in contributing towards financial health and an improved reality in terms of the citizens' experience or the use of resources. the demonstration of ethical behavior and professionalism by all the players, so that we just take this for what it is. If there are weaknesses, if there are improvements, I think we are also ready to highlight those when we find them. So that, in essence, share the type of aspirations that we have set aside for ourselves as an institution, to say, let's rather have something that we can continuously work towards, even if it's over this next 10 years. We know that it may not all be completely achieved in 10 years. It might be achieved even later than that, if anything. But the point is, at least we know as an institution, we are gathering our energies around influencing and strategically making an impact in these areas, because we think these areas are largely what would be a foundation for a strong and capable administrative core of activities in the area of public service as well as financial management. Well, as far as the value adding assurance provider, this is about us making sure that the reports that we issue, including the performance audits that we do, are relevant, timely, and respond to some of the key focus areas. We said, for example, when we elevate our focus and performance audit, it is going to take a glance in the area that attracts most of the resources that are being spent. And we've highlighted those, for example, to be programs in education, to be programs in health and infrastructure, as well as social service spend. A combination of those four together, when we look at them, adds up to quite a significant focus, or rather a significant component of what is appropriated in terms of the estimates of national expenditure. And in yet, this area, Chair, of providing a value-adding inputs, we largely rely on this document, which was released 2 days ago, the estimates of national expenditure document. This is a document that articulates the programs that are carried out in respect of all departments that we audit. And for us, this is the best place to look at how best can we fund ourselves to be relevant in respect of the challenges of the day, as well as in respect of our response to the National Development Plan. We move from the premise that we have not engaged fully with the document itself, the National Development Plan, as an institution in coming to this. However, what we know is that that which has been decided is going to be translated into the medium-term strategic framework, which will be articulated here. So if this becomes our source preference in developing our focus areas, both in terms of the regularity and performance audits, we would, by implication, be responding to what has been aligned based on what the National Development Plan needs. Right. Just in terms of the focus of our work, Chair, we will be focusing our work and reporting on our insights on the outcomes of our audits, as we have been doing all along. We will also be aiming this strategic plan to enhance our effectiveness in influencing leadership to drive basic controls. That's the point I was referring to in terms of our refocused approach to the enhanced control reviews. Improvement of our own organization is going to be another key focus over the next couple of years, as well as continuing to contribute globally in the work that we do as part of the global audit environment. And no doubt the area of investing in a diverse, highly skilled and independent professional staff is still continuing, because it is on the back of those people who are highly trained and are well versed with the operations of the audit office that we are likely to continue to guarantee providing work of a credible nature. So these will be the key focus areas as we go forward into the future. What we've done is, in terms of this 2015 to 2024 period, in evaluating the key focus areas, as we said, we had 5 goals that we have been driving over the last 7 years up to this year that we are reporting on. But now we have reorientated our focus areas in terms of these goals to reflect goal 1, 2, 3, and 4, which I'm going to deal with in detail in the next slides. If we look at the transitions that we are trying to drive in terms of the strategic plan, where we are building up on issues of simplicity, clarity, and relevance, and visibility, funding, strengthening human capital, and lead by example. Those 5 goals, we've largely collapsed a lot of the things we were doing there, including new others, into now what we're going to be referring as the 4 strategic goals. So this strategic plan that we are presenting is largely going to focus on the value-add auditing, which does not lose any of the stuff that we've built up on Abuja's current period in terms of issues of simplicity. They are still part of the parcel of the value add, but there's more stuff that we are now focusing on to say, let us run audit what matters, so that all the things that matter are largely responding to what an audit report ought to communicate. Secondly, we're still going to be dealing with visibility, but more driving the agency in respect of the impactfulness of the visibility. Whereas in the past, it would have been an investment into the visibility, because many people in the system were not used to this idea of having to engage with auditors frequently. And we thought that we would take baby steps to build up on that investment, to build up on that awareness, to build up on that alertness about it. But now, as we look at the audit outcomes, there's a great potential to translate them into very, very positive outcomes if we could focus on the impact element of our facility. Issues around our operations, as well as what we do from a human capital point of view, what we do with the finances and what we do with the facilities that we use, as well as the technology that we have available, as well as many other networks that we operate with, is going to be focused in terms of our strategic goal under viability. And it's always going to be about answering the question, are we viable as an audit institution to continue to carry out our mandate as prescribed? And those questions would be looking at our financial position, looking at our attractiveness in the market with regards to the skills that we need, as well as looking at all manner of things, including the independence of our staff, the ethics, and all other things. The vision and the values is largely the lead by example, but we are not to translate it very clearly now and say there are specific values and a vision that we are driving as an office. Are we all aligned? Are we all on the same path? Do we all understand the rules of the game? Do we know that it is important for us to continue to produce a clean set of financial statements and a good, well-managed, strong financial environment? Those are the type of questions that we are going to be articulating in those four goals. And on the value add one, as I indicated, the detail around it will be to focus on areas that matter and influencing the public sector to utilize funds for the intended benefit. That largely what the focus of those areas will be. So when we report on them, we will be highlighting on the issues that are coming out of the audits with a view to influencing those that make decisions to continue to find ways to make sure that the public funds are used for the purposes intended. And some of the places where we find the purpose intended is here. Because here, this is the articulation of what is the purpose for which some of the funds that we audit was meant to achieve. Hence, the escalation of our role in the performance audit will also come into the picture. Our footprint, and interestingly, in public sector-funded organizations, we were asked a question yesterday about the completeness of all those institutions, those 1,021 odd institutions. It's always a battle to find what the true number is, because there are different places where all these entities get registered when they are brought about. But this, our focus at least now will be to try and have our footprint in a number of the public-funded organizations. Visibility for impact. As I said, Chair, we want to transform and translate what we come out in our audit through the different interventions and interactions and oversight to influence good outcomes in this audit, as well as to find ways to also clarify certain of the things that are contained in our reports, because they are not always easy to understand in the public domain and in other broader civil society or institutions that might help in this. So we also are focusing on thought leadership so that we clarify ourselves what we mean by certain of the words that are used. For example, some of the words that are there as members have indicated, and I know they didn't say this, but sometimes they strike horror when one hears a word like irregular expenditure or unauthorized expenditure, and then people get horrified. And perhaps there might be a place to find a way to provide thought leadership behind what those things are about, so that there is more clarity as part of the advocacy work in this area of visibility for impact. Because it is true that these things always lend themselves to some interpretation. If it's irregular, then people will take the view of the worst case scenario in their interpretation, and sometimes never have an appreciation of a lot of the in-betweens that are taking place, which are not necessarily negative. On the viability side, this is again holding us accountable, Chair, with regard to saying that we have been given an institution that we must make sure that it has a presence that can be appreciated for the value that it plays. It is an institution that must be seen to be providing leadership in how it maintains its independence. And this is largely about the people that put it there so that they can continuously be independent and also be seen to be independent. The issues about our financial modeling also attract attention, as we have shared yesterday. We also want to focus on our viability, as we are dealing with an organization that is going through change as well, in that we constantly feed into the organization no less than 400 people every year, and some go because they would have finished their articles and all that. So there's no question about the fact that we also often have to lubricate our system from time to time to make sure that we integrate people properly and get them to flourish, both in terms of their own development as well as the development of the machinery of the office. So the viability focus area in terms of the third goal is largely going to be seized with those issues of internal organizational as well as institutional growth and development. The vision and the values goal, which is our fourth goal, Chair, will also be about tracking issues of transformation, looking at the lives of the 665 million that we allocate, among others, as contractors. If you look at that number, we predetermine that number as an example upfront when we say, here's the total quantum of work that we have to do. Here's the reality that we have in respect of the people that we have in the organization, which by assumption suggests that we cannot have all the people that we need, because there will be times when they are not busy but need to be paid. So we went the route of saying the private sector, what terms, will come in handy in assisting us with delivering this work. And we put it under these goals around transformation to say we will also have a preference in providing this work so that it cuts across many auditing institutions. And I can assure members, I'm not sure what the numbers are, I'm sure the CFO will help later on in terms of the speed of the numbers. But in principle, when we allocate this work, we do an allocation upfront for 2 years, where at the beginning we issue a tender document where all the firms that are eligible to apply for work, we process it and we evaluate it based on the criteria that we have developed as an office. We've got a very strong criteria that takes into account issues of footprint in terms of where the firm exists in the Northwest. We'll have a preference to give work to those firms that are in the Northwest for Northwest audits, as an example. And so it goes other provinces. But the split of this is between all the big four firms, as we know them, the medium-sized firms, as well as the small firms. So many players in the accounting and auditing profession, both firms that are emerging as in small and medium enterprises, participate in the work. But I'm sure the detail in terms of the specific numbers, the CFO can assist with that. Our own governance as an office, to make sure that we do the things that we expect to happen elsewhere, is part of the focus of our vision and values, as well as to develop a risk-intelligent organization so that we're not just focusing on auditing the numbers as we see them, but we also respond to the risks associated with the numbers that we audit, as well as the environment in which we audit. Our brand presence, both locally and internationally, like we said, Chair, we go around the country with a specific purpose, and that purpose is to share with the public domain the outcomes of our work. We seldom go in the public domain to go talk about other things. We normally go talk about the outcome of the work that we've done. And when we confront other questions, we nicely ask not to answer them in most instances, because we value the fact that we've got the public, the opportunity to engage in public, but we also must respect the fact that we have a mandate to report only on the work that we do. And for us, we think that it helps in aligning our brand as an audit institution that tries to promote public confidence. Internationally, we have got some roles that we have been assigned, which we continue to play. As I said earlier on, we have been entrusted with a massive responsibility as the chair of the Capacity Building Committee of INTOSAI, which has got a lot of international responsibilities attached to it. And those are two areas that from a brand presence point of view is important for the local stakeholders, but it's also important for our peers who operate in different parts of the world. The main key initiatives, Chair, we have basically identified a couple of initiatives under each goal, which we are going to articulate very clearly together with the measures that come with them, so that the committee at an appropriate time, when we come to them, having translated this into annual plans, we can be able to engage with the committee on the progress achieved, as well as the impact of any of these initiatives in relation to what we had planned. So I'm not going to go into any much detail in terms of the initiatives, but I'm sure there will be an opportunity to find time to deal with them when we get it on an annual plan. These initiatives that we identify under each one of the goals, perhaps just to make that point, are initiatives that we are going to plot across a timeline. Obviously, they can't all be targeted for a particular year. There are certain ones which we will introduce as we go along in the strategic plan. Which brings me back to the first question that we raised, yesterday, regarding the fact that, what about the fact that there are changes that are taking place in the environment, and we are busy reporting on something that we formulated some time ago. And the answer to that, as I was reflecting on this part of the slides, is that we do have an adaptable and flexible approach to our strategy plan and business plan. When we look at some of the initiatives and the key risks emerging, when we go through some of the stuff in the estimates of national expenditure, for example, we would align whatever we have said we will do in terms of our specific initiatives so that we are not falling out of line with what the current environment is. So it does provide space for an adaptable pursuit of the same objective, but it always must be informed by what is currently of significance now. For example, the focus that we are now driving around the likes of infrastructure audits, in performance audits, in education, in health, they were not there at the time when that strategic plan was developed some 7 or 8 years ago. We were responding to things as they were emerging in the current environment, hence the adaptability of the strategic plan in terms of key initiatives and focus areas. As I said, given those ones, those initiatives, if we just run through all those initiatives, 3 and 4, we will go through them when the time gets to it. And then, towards the end, in terms of the cascading, the cascading process of this strategic plan, obviously we kind of, as I said, have our eye into the horizon to figure out how to run the world with regards to financial management, much as the public sector look. We then translated that into a strategic plan and a budget, which we know that we would have to submit by the end of January. And then we also, from here, start looking at the strategic plan and budget and engaging the organization to develop an organizational balance scorecard, because as we exist across all 9 provinces, we constantly have to align our offices to the vision that we're driving, as well as the organizational alignment itself. If the organization is aligned to what we are driving overall, chances of success are much greater. So the huge amount of effort that we spend in this, as we have illustrated in the organogram, how we operate and how we structure our interventions in this area of work as an office. We will also develop it into business and business unit and portfolio balance scorecards, because there are certain unique initiatives that will attach to the people in the Eastern Cape, which may not necessarily be applicable in Gauteng or Limpopo. And that's where we start making sure that business units in areas where they operate have a better sense in respect of what they must be doing. And then lastly, the individual performance contracts, which attach a contractual agreement between ourselves as well as the staff, to make sure that at an individual level, every individual employee in the office has got an opportunity to contribute something, but also an opportunity to pull from the staff that we have put out here. Just in terms of the strategic plan, those are the key highlights of what is going to be put around the strategic plan. Those are the things that we are gearing ourselves as an office to drive, and that's the task that we want to engage with the committee on as we start out this first year of the strategic plan, as we will be implementing it after we've previously had inputs. In terms of translating it into a budget, Chair, we've used the principles in our budgeting, which largely came from our review of the funding model, where we said we want to set aside back for purposes of contract work, which is at least no less than 20%, it's always been between 20 and 30% of the amount of work that we have, which we dish out for purposes of making sure we meet our reporting deadlines. The gross profit margin is already taken into account from determining the fee that we charge less the people who are directly involved in the audit. So for every rent, therefore, that we charge, we only left with 32 friends to deal with our overheads, and then after we paid for our overheads in terms of the running cost of the office and so on, we then left with the surplus, which is largely the number that sits between, according to the budget here, 3% for the past year, but estimate going forward in the budget is a surplus of about 1% of the total fee base. The key issues that have been driving the contract work that we are allocating, it is due to vacancies. For example, when there are major vacancies in certain business units and they are not able to respond to the delivery requirements for the audit, when there are scope increases, maybe we get an additional departmental entity to audit, or we've got additional areas to focus on, as well as a number of other inefficiencies. Always a result in us having to ask for assistance outside. So this assistance is carefully managed inside the office through what we call a contract works committee, which is responsible for regularly evaluating work that we're dishing out, as well as our tender committee gets involved. So we have got the necessary machinery in place to make sure that we don't do too much of this, because if we do too much of this, then there will be less work there for our people, which means they will have less exposure from a training point of view. So we try and balance this between how do we make sure our people get access to the work and be trained and exposed, because we are also a training office, as well as how can we make sure we deliver timelessly on our commitments. And these are the numbers in terms of the income statement, Chair. The fee income, the direct expenditure line, which is largely the employment cost of the people that we employ, including the work that we dish out, because those will be the costs directly attributable to the generation of that revenue. And the rest of it will be contribution to overheads and other related expenditure. So those will be the core area of focus that we'll be putting into our budgets. The key drivers of the overhead expenditure, many of them are employment-related expenditure costs, the investment in the information technology environment, learning and development, accommodation, and so on. So those will be the large areas of expenditure outside of the people that recover the work in terms of the professional staff. And in addition, we'll have to meet those costs to run our offices across the country. The tariffs, in terms of their projection from a growth point of view, we are still trying to get them in terms of year-on-year growth to less than the CPI. As we can see that we have been driving a flattening of the fee increase so that we do not put in a huge amount of burden on the financial system. But one of the things in trying to make sure that we do not impose huge costs on the system, we've embarked on a project in terms of some of the initiatives that we've highlighted, which is what we call the audit and efficiency project, where we are trying to identify much smarter and more effective ways of delivering the same work, but at a significantly lower cost, so that we can have continuous efficiency. I mean, we haven't done the exercise to a great extent, but we started with some, where we say that if we are used to doing a particular audit for 2,000 hours, we know that over the last couple of years that we have been making an investment, there are certain elements of inefficiency that could have flown into that cost base. That's what we are trying to unpack now, to make sure that we don't carry inefficiencies into the cost base of the audit, because people will experience the fee to be quite high if suddenly they are no longer having those inefficiencies that they used to have. So we're busy with sorry, sir, it's me. I forgot now. I forgot, it's me. I was attempting to see, because this is the last slide in terms of the financial numbers. I was attempting to see if there are any specific questions, and I hope that the team and the DAG will come in and add in areas that I have not answered. But some of my questions are in my iPad, so this iPad is preventing me from seeing those questions now because of the heckling that's happening here. Chair, if I may just pause there and ask the DAG to pick up one or two that I may not have answered, and Eugene and the CFO will also help where necessary. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before we remind you of the questions, because as we said, it's about assisting us. But just from a member's point of view, we've now received what the AG is saying they want to do over the next 5 years. I think for us it's a question of, are there any glaring gaps that we think they've not covered? because it's there that in terms of how we want to see South Africa growing. Are there any glaring gaps that we can listen to? You know, your stress test is not covering ABC. If it's covering all those things, it's fine. We don't have to engage on them. So if there's any glaring gaps, you can raise them. But the kinds of questions, let me just remind you, because I think time is going to catch up with us. The ones that I've covered, and no particular order. Interest on outstanding debt, local government specifically. Internal audit to be part of the briefing, which is on your comments. Because that was just a skill. These are the things that members will raise when they, when we engage. The selection of your undergraduates, what is the process? Is it just the ones off? The continuity, you have company A, year one, and then company B, year two. Does that have any implications? Is the 30-day target that has been set to pay creditors affecting you negatively, positively? Are you going to be able to meet that? Your rural schools, why are you starting in grade 10 instead of grade 8? And the CSI initiatives, just why not changing them? From yesterday, your programs, and others already, if I'm mistaken, your programs, are they ad hoc or have you planned them? Remember you were going to visit school and so on, because you said you think it's a good idea. You've spoken about the profit markup, I think we have to do that. Our view on directly briefing the external auditors, not that you're going to dictate what we're going to do, but I mean that's the view that came up. If you want to comment, and others, if you don't want to comment, you don't have to comment, because I mean these are things that members will raise. The actuarial gain is 7.8. What is it? Please explain that to us. Your notebooks that were lost on page 120. What is going on? And why is there no insurance? If there is no insurance, you've covered the checking. And then somebody asked yesterday the 80% target, how do you reach it? I'm not sure what it was. I remember there's something called 80% target. 87% target. Yeah. If you could just talk to that. And who is auditing the auditor general was another question, if you want to talk to that, because those are more or less the questions. And those you don't want to respond to, you don't have to. But those will be, I'm sure, the things that we will discuss with you alone, and then try and present this answer about them. So if you could respond to those questions. Also, I mean, some of them, you don't have to respond or feel the pressure, but if you give us we can give you 7 days to respond to some of them, because I would imagine it would be a week or so, only before we write. For instance, the question on what is your breakdown of your contractors? You might not know now that the 65 million, so much goes to PE, so much goes to business. If you don't have it, you can give it to us in writing. And of course, as the AG has said, if there's principal agreement on this, they will then go to their annual program, which will then be measurable. So that we can say to them, you said this is what you're going to do in this time, and that of course will come later on. And then from my side, basically, members, just to indicate that, and this summarizes so that we don't, and we can debate this on our own after the weekend. It seems that they are saying they will contribute in terms of strengthening internal audits or the finance partners. That's part of their contribution. That they will be looking at getting to a stage of vigorous financial activity, auditing activity, and consequences thereof. That they themselves internally will structure a competent staff, and the staff that is a supplier of choice, for want of a better word, upon the retention side of it, plus all the financials that they have given us, and that they will continue to play a role in the global activities of public accounts, which is also our drive that we must have a better Africa and a better world. I think it covers most of the things that government is looking at. Generally, I think they're covering all things. That's why I'm saying if there are any other glaring stuff, please put it to them. So generally speaking, I think we're more or less comfortable, unless members see something clearer. We will write our report, because we're different to other committees, AG and your staff. We're not going to write our report and you'll be shocked the next morning when it appears on the ATC. We will write our report, we'll debate it, and with the agreement of the committee, like you do when you go and have a discussion with your own chief, not that they can change your opinion, I think we will have that case. One of us will come to you and say, you know, we've discussed this whole thing, this is broadly what we are saying, so that you don't get shocked in the next morning in the ATC. Ours is really not our strong. Ours is just to say as a team are we going in the right direction. But once we have a, before we publish it, I'm sure we're going to say to you this is the flavor of the report that we will then present to Parliament and to the public by default. So that's really how we're going to do it. We will ask you to respond. Members can then, if you are comfortable, we'll just scratch it off and not scratching it off, or just keep it for the discussion internally. We don't have to then debate with them anymore because they've now given us what they think. But I'll allow you, ma'am, and then we'll allow the department, office to respond. Yeah, ma'am.
Yeah, I think one of the things that they should assist us with is in terms of municipalities that also. I think they indicated yesterday that mostly were rural, which means the affordability, there will be an affordability problem. But going forward, how do we then as government address the issue? Because then it will come, you know, time and time again. Together, how do we, you know, deal with the issue? Not make recommendations, we were supposed to make the recommendation. Because if it comes in the old from time to time, you know, it will seem like we don't want to solve the problem and we don't want to deal with it. So I think it will assist us a lot.
I deliberately left that one out because I thought that is our own internal matter. Together with the how do we rephrase the irregular and so many those type of things. I thought those are things that we will discuss. One question that I left out, somebody asked yesterday, why do you only focus on Fort Hare and not anybody else? Why does Fort Hare not anybody else? I think your academics was 3 million rand into Fort Hare. So if you could just respond to some of those questions, because I thought those will be raised. Is there something we need to answer?
Just a matter of clarity, Chair, if I may. Thank you, Mr. Quickie, for your explanation as to the surplus and debt. But if I understood you correctly, the surplus is the difference between the invoice amount and the cost of what you're charging for. Whether or not that invoice is paid, that's irrelevant. Does that then say to me that your services stated here, I think 496 million, includes 322 million that's owed to you by local municipalities? Am I understanding it correctly?
Thank you very much, Chair, once again. I think I've been talking too much now, so let me hand over to the chief.
So I dare not talk about someone else. Good morning, members. I'll start by answering some of the sort of call it non-financial questions, and I'll ask the CFO to deal with the two matters in particular regarding the laptops and the actual valuation that ends up again in our financial. The question raised about school visits, indeed we conduct school visits in different parts of the country, and it is done with a view to inform students or learners in high school about the profession and the potential for them to enter and advance within the profession. But it's also done just by and do target grades 10 to 12 because that's really the critical time around getting them to focus on their studies and making sure that they align to the key requirements that be required when they want to enter the profession, certainly at undergraduate level. We also have learners from different high schools visiting us in all of our provincial visits. We have a day for girl learners and a day for boy learners, and we do spread that beyond even grade 8. And so from grade 8 onwards, just in terms of giving them exposure to the website. The question about who audits the office. The audit firm is Quinana ABC Auditors, and they are appointed at the moment for a 3-year period. They've just finished the first year of that 3-year period, which has been the basis of a decision by the audit committee supported by the previous SCOAC in the fourth parliament. The audit committee in their report, that's sitting in the annual report that they talked to us yesterday, have reconfirmed that they've reviewed, as they're supposed to, the continued independence and appropriateness of using Kulana for the forthcoming year. So that is all in order, and they are completely independent of us as an audit office, and they work under the direction and oversight of the audit committee. The question about how do we determine that 87% target on the quality control is really about looking at the quality of our audits, and we have a process that has key audit files are listed on a random basis to test them in terms of whether or not our audits do meet with the appropriate levels of quality, compliance with international auditing standards. And the detailed review on those selected files, and the 87% indicate to what extent they have passed the test by people independent of that audit team. So there still are people, but they're independent of that audit team. We've been quite fortunate that all of those files have reached at least an 87% level of a pass over the past 2 years. What about the allocations for the contract work? The key components of our allocation criteria are transformation and our quality. So we require everybody, whether they're a big firm, a medium-sized firm, a black firm, a small firm, to submit their EE scorecard, which looks at all the 7 elements that are specified in the EE code, but also in the CHR. And that's to contribution around ownership, environmental equity, management control, all of those key elements that are sitting there. And all of them have a minimum requirement to score on that scorecard. So everybody is a contributor to be on some level. So the full extent of that 65 million is allocated to people who contribute on some level. A third of our work in the past has gone to small firms who indeed do contribute in some way. But over and above that, we consistently do analysis of how we can deepen transformation through the work that we allocate to the profession. And we look at additional contributions to the level of ownership, to the level of gender empowerment, really with the sense of saying, how can we deepen transformation with the allocation that we put into the profession? Over the past year, we've allocated, of the 665 million, 152 million has gone into black firms. Some of them are small, some of them are medium-sized. And I hope that does answer the question. Can I ask that the CFO deals with the two methods, and then we'll quickly take over to see if there's others that are still in the decision. Thanks.
Thank you, DHN, and honorable members. On the question of the actuarial gain, this deals with a retirement benefit obligation, and in particular, it deals with the medical aid post-retirement that becomes due to a limited number of members that have been in employment before 1999. And the benefit becomes available to them on retirement until they live, and then after that on the surviving spouse. So the accounting standard basically prescribes that on an annual basis, an independent actuary must test the various components that makes up the obligation. For example, how long will members live, as an example. And that variable is tested on an annual basis. And through a various mathematical computation, the actuary is then determined what is a realistic obligation we would need to reflect on our books to cover the obligation going into the future. So the actuarial gain or loss, as it may happen from year to year, is basically a difference in the estimate of the obligation that we would need to keep on our books, has a fair reflection of our obligation in terms of the medical liability for retirees. Currently, there are 192 members that have retired and are enjoying this benefit, and there are 200 members in employment currently that will enjoy this benefit when they retire in the future. In terms of the laptops, Chair, the figure was actually 119,000 rands. It represents about 60 laptops that were lost in the financial year. And the nature of our business is such that we have people traveling all over the country at different times, and they are prone to these kinds of thefts that do occur. On average, we lose between 50 and 60 laptops a year. Yes, I'm coming to that, Chair. Thank you very much. Yes. Chair, on an annual basis, we do what we call a cost-benefit analysis in terms of computing the cost of our loss as opposed to the cost of insurance. And because of the mobility of these laptops, insurance is prohibitively costly. And we then conclude whether to self-insure or not. And up to now, we have concluded to self-insure. Chair, that's about all from my side. Thank you.
Strengthening our allocations around the contract work, we've actually been doing it now for a longer period, where we used to allocate on an annual basis and then the risk that people would get different auditors, we now allocate for a three-year period, so at least there is that level of continuity and a journey that can be walked between the auditee as well as the key auditor on that particular part. The question about interest on debt, especially to due from municipalities, we do charge interest on debt that's owed by everybody, and that's required of us to do in terms of the law. We have been entering into ring-fencing arrangements with municipalities as a way to help them pay and focus on managing their cash flows and settle the outstanding debt. Some have taken advantage of that ring-fencing opportunity, which helps us to manage actual payments and settlement of the debt, but others haven't. And those that do take advantage predominantly do get benefit out of it because they're able to focus on monthly or quarterly payments consistent with their retention. But however, we're not allowed, the law requires of us to charge and continue to strive to collect. The selection of the undergraduates that participate on the KEY program, there are two programs. There's one that we contribute to Tsuka Bursary Fund, which is a project that is run throughout the accountancy profession and centered at SICA, which is the Institute for Chartered Accountants. We contribute to that. We currently fund 40 students in that fund alongside auditing firms and accounting firms throughout the profession. We also get a benefit of being able to access those students when they do qualify, when they do finish their studies and they come in and train with us. The second program, which is slightly different, is one that we run our own. It's one that we launched in the context of our centenary celebration. That's why it was a one-shot. But the students that are there, they were selected on the basis of financial needs, but also academic performance and academic potential. They are located in different parts of the country. They come from different parts of the country, and they currently work studying at different universities in different parts of the country. They are being sponsored for the full term of their academic base. This wasn't a once-off in the context of what's been awarded to the individual. The day-to-day target, I think I need to ask the CFO to respond to that as well. And why Forte? The University of Forte is one of the first two universities to have been the beneficiary of a project that the Association for the Advancement of Accountants of South Africa, together with SICA, launched to improve the capacity, the lecturing capacity at those universities, really with a view of improving capacity where black people are. ensuring that we have more training platforms for aspirant chartered accountants. So that program focused on Limpopo as well as Auchan. At a point in time, Auchan approached our office to say, we're making such significant progress in the journey towards building capacity around subvention of lesser salaries, but we need more if we're able to, so that we can sustain the gains we're making. And it was on that basis that we entered into this partnership with the University of Auchan. Our office works very closely with University of Limpopo, with UKZN, with Fortier, Vindicated, UWC, and all with a view to finding ways to support these universities, and I must add, Walter Sisulu University as well. All with a view to supporting them, even if it's not in financial terms, but also in terms of whether it's providing tutor support, where some of our staff engage in that, whether it's even in the form of mentoring students. We have, as an office, the benefit of many of our CAs who have qualified and understand the journey of what it takes to actually qualify as a chartered accountant and are so well positioned to mentor and guide students at different universities in the areas where we operate. Then I'll hand over to the finance team on the 38th August.
Thank you, DAG. Chair, the AG had a target of 45 just previously and has a benchmark in the PFNA, although not regulated by the PFNA. We have dropped it to 30 days. And this was mindful of the fact that we want to assist our creditors, our suppliers, so to speak, which include the emerging black firms with their own cash flow. And in this way, we try and pay quicker and thus create the cash flow that they need to operate their businesses. So it's a positive move, not a negative one. Well, you know, in the overall scheme of things in terms of our own cash management, it's what we can cope with currently, despite the illiquidity from our local government water teams.
A few items, if I could just ask in the document we were given last week, the draft, should it then, but I just had two issues that came up there. One's on page 18, where it says, under heading align internal competencies and capabilities through increasing the number of qualified professionals belonging to various professional bodies. I just wondered, is there more than one professional body that you tap as a source of people coming in? Are they all just joint accountants or the other disciplines as well? And then on page 20, I was a little alarmed when I read that in determining the areas on which we should focus our auditing, we will be guided by what matters to ordinary South Africans outlined in our long-term strategy. We will cover the following, and then the second bullet point says delivery of services in line with what's been promised to the public. And I thought that that's a bit of an alarming statement to make. It should be what's in line with constitutional mandate or obligations, not what's being promised to the public. You know, politicians have a tendency to promise all sorts of things to the public that they shouldn't. I don't think that's what the auditor general should be auditing. Then I wanted to ask from the same question, just as a matter of interest, of all the local municipalities that owe you money, have any of them had clean audits? Because surely it would be a contradictory kind of thing if they owe you the money, but they'd be doing a clean audit. That was just an interesting question, a thought that crossed my mind. And yes, I want to get clarity about this question I asked already about the surplus and the debt, because can I just add to that? Because another thing that pops up, I was looking at the second or last page on the presentation that I was now. There's the item of appreciation or depreciation. I wanted to know, is this an actual cash amount you've got stashed somewhere, or is it the usual trick of balancing your books by adjusting your depreciation out? I know it's a trick that's used all over the place, and auditors hate it, but maybe you use it yourselves because you're aware of what you've got. So I just wanted to know if it's impact on the situation as well. Thank you.
On one of the things that I thought we didn't respond to. Following on the question on the surplus and the debt outstanding, the one which is the surplus coming from the example I made, well, there's two sets to the financial statements. One on the surplus is sitting in the income statement, because that's the income and expenditure statement where that surplus is. Whereas the debt, because when there is the invoice, we make a credit and then before we get the payment and we raise the debt, make a debit to the balance sheet. So that debt is sitting in the balance sheet. I think the question was, is that debt also included in the surplus? And the answer is, the surplus on its own, which is sitting in the income statement, is the income minus expenditure, which gives us the surplus. But because the other leg of this income that we raised, we put it in the debt as it's sitting on the balance sheet side. So we are sitting in two separate statements. Because the other one is about an asset that we can recover, whereas the other one is about the result of our activity based on our income and expenditure statement. And that will also add to the depreciation question. It is effectively the reduction of the value of the assets. So, yeah. So it's not cash in a sense. It's really just recognizing the fact that the value of the asset is much lower than it was when it was bought. And therefore that entry goes through income statement as a book entry. So there's no flow of cash that happens as a result of that. Especially when we develop our cash flow statement to determine what our cash position is, things like depreciation we must add back, because we started with the surplus figure, and therefore we must add back all the non-cash items in order to come back to what our cash holding is. So it is in that nature. And just putting on that question, I assume that you also want to engage with it. When we look at it in terms of surplus, it really is an outcome of the net effect of all the estimates, because a lot of the stuff we really are figuring out how long it's going to take to audit, and based on that and based on our experience and our best possible efforts. Because all of this happens after we have with the client, after we engage them, and after we assess the environment as to how we think it might come out on the audit. We end up with that, and we pay for the people who do the work on our behalf, all those professors and audit people, obviously. That number comes in there, including the contract work, including our facilities, including all manner of initiatives that we undertake. At the end of it, on the income statement side, we end up with a net figure. In this instance, for this year, it's the 99 million. However, when it comes to the sustainability of our activities, when it comes to the flow of cash, that is where we get hamstrung, because it's in that area that there's no real movement. And the movement can only be created by deposits in the bank. But to take into account the fact that those deposits in the bank do not come as quickly as we expect them, we also reduce this surplus. So that it takes into account the fact that there are many people out there who ought to have paid us who have not paid us. Because the reality might be that if we don't get paid for the next 18 months and we were owed 200,000 by a particular entity, 18 months later, that 200,000 would have shrunk in value. So we recognize the fact that the value of that 200,000 is now much smaller in terms of what we expect to get from them. We might say, if they take 18 months to pay us, it probably means they don't have 200,000. They might have 100,000. And therefore, we also recognize in the surplus the fact that there may be delays in receiving this money. By the time it comes, it may no longer be 200,000. Because when it comes as 100,000, it means we will be having another 100,000 left in debtors, which will never be paid, which means we must then write it off in the books. So when we reduce the value of it, we are taking into account the fact that we might have to write off in the books the balance of what is not paid. And that's basically how that surplus is arrived at, in essence. And Chair, I think the bulk of the questions are covered, Chair, and the last point I just want to make is that for us, we are indeed quite grateful for this opportunity. We have done our homework with regard to also engaging the senior management across the whole office at a time when we surfaced the areas that we want to focus on in our strategic plan over the next 7 years or 10 years. We know that it's going to be a tough journey because it's going to also require us to deal with issues of change management, because when people in institutions are used to doing things a particular way, and you introduce a dynamic that takes them to a higher plane. There's all sorts of things that we need to be on the lookout for. So this is going to keep us busy, but we've got methods at least to try and make sure that as we focus on the implementation of some of these things that are very real, that we always maintain the balance of making sure that we do not disappoint on the side of delivering on our mandated responsibilities, because it may be easy for this to drag us into a lot of internal focus, but we will try and maintain that balance. But secondly, also, this change, because it's a change, it will also meet some difficulties along the path in terms of trying to convince and persuade. And I think, Chair, we will be looking forward to those regular engagements with the committee once all of it has been put to bed and we have articulated very clearly in terms of the budget and the numbers what it will translate into. Because these activities and these initiatives, when we go back now that we've got a sense of your feeling about it, we will then have to take it down to the multi-year planning cycle so that we can at least locate in every single one of these years what we believe is humanly possible to do, because a lot of these things will also find traction based on what we do best, because some of them will be about laying the foundation for doing some of the bigger things maybe in year 4 or in year 5, depending on which things we align in the priority list. So that will take care of that issue, Honourable Member, which was raised regarding the multiplicity of initiatives that have what might be a limited budget. And of course, we were cognizant in looking at this as well that systemically there's also a number of financial pressures. So we will try and leverage on the insights and skills that we have, but there will be instances where we may need to get assistance and help. And I think the resources that are at our disposal, we will aim to utilize them for driving these initiatives over the next couple of years. On that note, Chair, I would like to also, on behalf of the team, I thought you were professional.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson and Honourable Members. I'll deal with the first question in terms of what influenced the time that we spend on the audit. The nature and the size of the municipality, for example, will be a factor. If you take, for example, you compare a metro to a local rural municipality, a metro by its nature, it's got more transactions that it has to deal with. It's got more activities compared to a rural municipality. So those factors will mean that you'll spend more time auditing a metro, for example, compared to a local municipality. But you may have similar municipalities where we spend different times auditing, because there are other factors that will also influence in terms of the quality of the information that we get. I think you made an example, Honourable Member, of where you might find that the accounting officer or CFO is not available. The longer we wait for information, that doesn't really prevent the clock from ticking, because when waiting, we accumulate the time at a time when we are not specifically doing any specific work other than just to have to wait. So those will be the factors where we might spend more time on one municipality as opposed to another. Also, the issues of the status of the internal controls. If you are a municipality that has got matured internal controls, the quality of the information that they produce, whether it's financial statements, whether it's performance information, it's of a higher quality as opposed to the municipality next door. That will also cause us to spend that time on that specific municipality. So those would generally be the factors that determine how much time we spend on one audit as opposed to the other. On the question of the costing, that as well it's in a way slightly linked to the level of the complexity of one audit as opposed to the other. And how it gets linked is that it then depends on the staff mix. Do we need a mix of much more experienced auditors to deploy in that particular municipality, or are the processes and the systems relatively basic that most of the work can be done by our junior auditors? Because in terms of the rate per hour that we charge as an office, it's dependent on the level or the rank and skill that particular auditor has. So in a way, as I said, that the complexities that we that pertain to an auditee will also have a factor in terms of the costings. I think the other question that was raised talks to the strategy that we have to deal with rural municipalities. I think maybe the one issue that we haven't mentioned is that, and this applies a lot to rural municipalities, those that in terms of their budgets cannot afford our fees. We have an arrangement, and it's provided for in our PAA, in our Act, that those municipalities are only required to pay 1% of our audit fee, with 99% of that fee being recovered from National Treasury. But there as well, there are certain constraints in that, in relation to what National Treasury budget, in a way to sponsor those municipalities, it doesn't fully cover the requirements from what we require in relation to the number of the municipalities that sit in the sphere. So that is the one way in which our office does get assisted by National Treasury, but it's a limited assistance that applies to those specific municipalities. I think the other question that I noted is around the professional bodies that we target as an office. We don't only train certain accountants, even though they comprise the largest portion of people that are in our training team. In addition to chartered accountants, who also train HCA, the AG made reference to them in his presentation. We also have right. You must have helped me with the rest. Okay. Yeah. All right. Now, I think it's a UK professional body of chartered accountants. I think the qualifications is relatively an equivalent to SBA, but it's much more UK based. So we've got some of our trainees that are going that route. We also have the registered government auditor, which is really a profession that is much more focused on our institution. So we've got that as a professional body. And I think there's also a professional body that for information systems auditors, I think it's called ICASA, might be ICASA, yeah. So those will be the typical professional bodies that we also attract as an organization over and above the chartered accountancy. In terms of any local municipalities that have achieved clean audits, I can't say A or nay in terms of this question, Chair, but it's possible that we might have a municipality that has got a long outstanding debt attaining a clean audit, because the two are not... Yeah, they're not particularly related. They can be mutually exclusive, because the evidence of the clean audit is that if they have a long outstanding audit debt to the AGFA, have they accounted for it accurately, and have they disclosed it appropriately? And if that's the case, then if we come and certify and we issue an audit report, it might as well be a clean audit. Thank you. I hope I've covered those questions.
Is that possible? I'm trying to talk to this lady, so that it's not comfortable that your business will be able to meet your grant vision or business
I'll start with the budget. The budget that we worked on and presented really talked to the forthcoming year, one that starts this April 2015, and we're comfortable we'll be able to operate within that. But I think as the age said, our initial focus is on ensuring that we prepare the ground for doing those things that are going to enable us to realize the vision. And indeed, it's something that we have to continue to work on and see what it is we can prioritize and what it is that we can do a little bit later. The biggest barrier is going to obviously remain our ability to collect on the work that the revenue that we do generate. And that limitation is one that is real. The question about auditing what matters and do we audit against the Constitution and what it is we're supposed to do, absolutely. So when we say what matters to people and we say, look at at what was promised, it's really in the context of saying when an entity puts together the annual performance plan, that's actually promised. And let's audit against the information that's sitting there and whether or not people are able to confirm whether it is useful, reliable, and can form the basis of a quality conversation between that entity and its key stakeholders. I think that's it. Let's check.
Can I refer everybody then to page 114 of the annual report, 114 of the annual report. And we have all the annual report, no? We do have.
Yeah.
Far away. No. Oh, today. Okay. All right. I think, and so I'm asking you to refer to it so that we don't walk out of here not understanding DAG, what it is. 140 says you've made a surplus this financial year of 99 million. However, we had a balance forward of 350 million. And therefore, the snapshot at the 31st of March or year end was 499 million. You're asking us to make a pronouncement on the 499 million. Or only on the 99. Because the other people have made pronouncements. That's what I want to clarify on. Okay. The department, the office made 99 million rand surplus this year. So though the accumulation is 499, they don't have a problem because we inherit it. But the 99 that they made now, we must decide whether we can say to them, use it as assurance for a going concern or give that to the National Treasury, which means they're 7,350, and what's the board, I wouldn't know how they survive. That's really what they're asking us for. I also want to refer members to page 102, which is the balance sheet. If you look at the balance sheet and talk as we would speak at home, they've got an obligation of almost 445 million. If we go shop today, that's their obligation. And collectively, there's also 449 that they could have in the bank for lack of a better word. So when you take a decision, I'm saying you must take it there in all those things in mind. So I'm putting the question to the committee. CC Nina, about that 99 million rand. Do we say to the AD, you can go home now and feel that it's right, or do we say, go and cut the salaries because you're not getting it? Niti. Do you want to do that? No, it's fine. No, but do you want to do that in committee? So you know you guys like to, you know, then it's obvious if you don't know, it's fine, we will come back, but I'm accurately reflecting what you want, isn't it? Right. You see, if it was me, I would have told you yesterday, but it's fine. What, how much time do you need, guys? 2 weeks won't kill you. All right. We will then pronounce on it, Johnny, how long will it take you to do your report? What I'm trying to say, we don't have to come back on a Friday, really, because all it's about adopting a course, even if we meet on a lunchtime. So I'm just trying to get a sense from, unless members say otherwise. My view is we can do this even on a Wednesday lunchtime. I don't know what time is the you know, although we're not although we're not trying to be our process, but let's try and name all of them. Cheers, yes.
Thank you, Chairperson. No, what I don't understand from the members is what is the problem with taking a decision, because the explanation is confusing with the surplus. Is there a problem? Because it's I'm not preparing it, but I'm trying to ask what is the error, because it has been explained to us.
You see, we have to protect the Parliament, isn't it? Yeah. I'll just do it to them. What we are saying, members, is that it's fine. We'll wait for the formal thing. But would I be very wrong by saying to these people they don't have loose sleep about it? All right. Because we don't commit ourselves, maybe they'll change their mind tomorrow. What I'm saying to you, don't lose too much sleep over it. We will dot the I's and cross the G's within the next 10 days and present everything to Parliament. Okay. All right. Thank you very much, members. Thank you very much to the AG and to everybody else that was here. And in our report, of course, we will reflect on even our own method of work. You guys recommended 3 times a year or 5 times a year. So that nobody shocked. If it's once a quarter, once a month, we will present our report. As we said, we'll have a dialogue before we make it public, and we can do whatever we need to do. AG?
Thank you. Just one thing I wanted to clarify, Jay, regarding the letter that you received from the Minister of Finance. I just wanted to clarify, I seem to have heard Chair saying we have now resolved it. The status of matter that has been raised, what I was referring to was that I had the letter when it came and you didn't have sight of it up to yesterday. It probably came ahead of our normal processes that we normally have with the accountants general. So this beginning of this week, without being aware that, I was aware that we were going to escalate it, but I didn't know there was a letter already. So this week we met with the accountants general, and we've already triggered a process to deal with this and other matters arising from the MFNA. So we have finally come to a conclusion, but we already have started the process.
Do you need our intervention? Can we say to Minister Nene that we think it won't be a crisis anymore because you guys are coming closer to it? Because I think he came to us to say, look, creating problems. But if we say that, no, between the two of you, you seem to be coming together doesn't mean you're going to agree on one thing, but at least you'll be common on your approach. Can we then write back and say, as far as we consider this message is work in progress, and we think that there will be some resolution? We'll respond just like that to the minister, and then before there's no need for a three-way meeting. If they want to engage us, they can, but our information is that you guys are doing something on it, and they can come back to Parliament in the event that you guys don't. Okay, so we will respond formally and we'll copy you on it. Apologies for giving it to you now. Anything from your side, Johnny, before we go? No, I have not been in touch yet, but let me just put it here. We had this discussion, AG, you best place, about conditions of employment. I had a meeting with the speaker on Monday off-site, and I've got correspondence that effect. The situation is that the previous committee wrote to the president after your appointment, saying there's the man, there's the information from those that decide, and this is what we recommend. The speaker had one or two questions, but subsequently sent it to the president. Our information is that he's either sitting with the president, or by now he or she, being the president, would have responded to you on that matter. So from speaker's point of view, because we are a subcommittee of speakers, from speaker's point of view, they have done what is required during the time of Sisulu. But if that is something that is still clogged somewhere, you just need to indicate to us so that I can go back to speak and say, indeed, we've done our leg, but can we push it because it's still sitting? And my understanding is that it would have gone all the way. Came from SCOAG, speaker commented, went to the president appoints, and does sign and does whatever. If that whole thing hasn't been done, all you need to say to us that it hasn't come back to you, and then we'll see the speaker look and pull it up. But from Parliament's side, we learn everything from outside. I thought I must just put that on the record because I've raised it. And I've got correspondence to that effect. So I'm not sure, we don't talk about it here, but if it needs to be, you can just say, look, it hasn't come in to you. And then I'll just talk to Malika if we can do that. Is that okay? All right. On that note, we will adjourn, and we agree now, committee, that once we've got a document, we'll give it to you. But really, we're going to need a lunch time to finalize. Is that okay? All right. Thank you very much, and to AJ and your team, thank you so much. We'll probably see you next year only. At this level, but we certainly will engage. But we will certainly meet in the next 2 weeks so that we can learn more about those processes. Thank you so much. Meeting is adjourned.